I'm John Bell O'Reilly, and I'm the researcher with Mooney Goes Wild.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, the mystery of the short-tailed shearwater, a bird that breeds in Australia and Tasmania and winters between Alaska and Hawaii. But just how did it end up on a beach in County Waterford? Richard Collins talks to the NUIG scientist who says that flushable wet wipes are causing damage to the marine environment and the creatures that live there. And an old friend of the programme, physiotherapist Jenny Brannigan, asked for our help with a bird that's nesting above her doorway.
It was one of my patients that actually brought this to our attention. And actually, he showed me an area where he spotted a sparrow had been bringing something up sort of into one of the eaves of the building. And then we kind of had a little further look and we spotted a couple of feathers around it. And then we saw that there was actually a nest up in the eaves.
Well, yeah, we're just looking up at the nest now. It's just here in a small, tiny little opening there, just in the roof, just as you go into the door.
Yeah. Yeah, well, certainly even beside the clinic here, there's lots of cars and people moving in and out. And you can see them even moving up and down now that I'm paying attention to them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's amazing. They're not scared by us at all.
So, a very busy programme ahead of us today. In the studio, we've got Aina Nilana. That is you, Aina, I believe.
Me, yes, even with the hair down to my ankles, it's me.
And Niall Hatch. Niall, you're very welcome to the programme again.
Thanks, Derek. Great to
Don't forget, you can text 51551 now. Niall gave me a tip-off on Friday, Niall.
Yes, a very exciting story. A bird that turned out to be a very strange creature called a short-tailed shearwater, a seabird that breeds in Australia, turned up on a beach at Tremor in County Waterford, a place where a short-tailed shearwater has really no business being. At this time of year, a lot of them would be off the coast of northern Japan. They do big circuits of the Pacific Ocean, but one shouldn't be in the Atlantic at all, let alone on a beach in Waterford. Now, unfortunately, the story had a slightly sad outcome. The bird didn't survive. So if it had, it would have probably got a lot of bird watchers from all over the continent coming to see it, because this is not only the first short-tailed shearwater for Europe, it's the first for the Western Palearctic. So Europe, North Africa and
they wouldn't have come because of COVID.
Oh, they probably would have come though. You know what twitchers are like. Anyway, let's talk to the man who found it. His name is Arlo Jakes and he lives in Waterford. Hello Arlo, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
Nice to speak with you. So tell us how you happened upon this bird.
Well, walking the dogs on the beach on a rainy Monday really was the start of the story, when I just saw the bird in front of me on the ground. The tide was out, so just a sandy beach, and there it was. I initially took it to be a rook because it's about the right size and colour for that, but obviously when I got a bit closer and the head turned and I could see it, it certainly wasn't any type of crow, and it was definitely a shearwater. Initially taken to be a Manx shearwater, because any shearwater that you see in Ireland is first of all likely to be a Manx.
Mm. And so this bird was on the beach there, and was it flapping around? Was it just sitting there? What was it doing?
No, it was completely still. It was obviously in distress. It was moving slightly and even shivering, which is not something that you want to see on a seabird.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, a shearwater being on land at all, like on a beach at this time of year, would be a warning sign, wouldn't it?
So what did you do? What did you do with it?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I took a couple of quick pictures with my phone, and then I picked up the bird to take a closer look. But as I did this, I had my dogs with me. And of course, if I pick up something on the beach, it's for the purpose of throwing. So I had to get the dog. My brother-in-law was with me. He took my dogs and I got the bird to a safe place at the back of the beach under some marram grass where I was the best I could do at the minute.
So these shearwaters, they're a group of birds called the tube noses. So they're related to albatrosses.
Tube noses.
They're great ocean wanderers. And they have this sort of long, thin beak, big, long wings. So obviously seeing one on a beach would be quite unexpected at the best of times. With the bird then, so you had this bird was eventually taken into care. And unfortunately, I believe it didn't survive. Do you know what the cause of death was? What caused it to perish?
No, the bird is going, there will be an autopsy performed on the bird, and that should reveal what the actual cause of death was.
Who identified the bird?
Well, it was Killian Mullarney that suggested that it might be a short-tailed initially. Paul Archer, another local birder, had been in contact with them. So then the measurements of what a short-tailed should be were taken. and everything fitted.
But unfortunately now, as Niall has said, the bird has perished, so you've sent it to the Natural History Museum, I believe.
That's right. Again, that was Paul Archer went and collected the dead bird and he's taken it to the Natural History Museum.
Well, Arlo, thank you very much indeed. How important is it to have this specimen, Niall?
Well, it's remarkable that the specimen actually survives or exists, because often when a bird is added to the Irish list for the first time, or the European list or whatever, it's a bird that's observed in the field, like a seabird flying offshore. We have definitive proof that this is a bird of this species. It'll be catalogued and preserved in the Natural History Museum, which is quite remarkable. So I think it's a real turn for the books, a bit of history there.
So even though the Twitchers didn't get a chance to see the live specimen, they can actually still come to Ireland when the lockdown is open up again and they can visit it at the Natural History Museum. I wonder how long that will take though.
Well, who knows? But the thing, of course, that's one of the big benefits of natural history museums. They record this for posterity. Mm. This is something that for generations to come we will know for sure was in Ireland.
But it's probably not on display at the minute because they won't be showing you a dead body. I mean, aren't they going to stuff it or do something that
they better prepare skin from it, assume, yes.
Reminds me of the belted kingfisher. Wasn't that the first one that ever came to these islands, to Europe, and it was shot and
it's in the museum now.
This one died presumably of exhaustion. How would it have come from Australia to here?
Well, you see, they're big travellers. So what they breed in Australia, Tasmania, that area, but they do sort of a circuit of the Pacific Ocean. So at this time of year, they would be in the Northern Hemisphere, usually around the coast of Japan, the Russian Far East, that kind of area, because, of course, their breeding season would be the Southern summer. So in the Northern summer, they're up in the Northern Hemisphere. They have two summers. So it's gone the right sort of distance north. It's just in the wrong ocean. It should be in the Pacific rather than the Atlantic. So, really a real turn up for the books.
But it's not the longest migrator, is it?
No, that's the
Arctic tern, isn't it?
That's the Arctic tern, that's right. And the Arctic tern, they go from the Arctic to the Antarctic, but they also go across Antarctica down as far as New Zealand and back up to Europe. Amazing. So they could cover 20,000 kilometres in a year.
Yeah, but that's a route. That's a route that we know. If you see a tern, you're not saying, God, that was in the Antarctic 6 weeks ago, because this wouldn't be amazing, because that's what it does. But this thing, this shearwater that lives in Australia, breeds there, is suddenly found in the beach in Tremore. Amazing.
Incredible, isn't it?
Well, it's fantastic. Well done to Arlo and to Killian Mullarney and to Adrian Allen and to everybody who's involved with that bird, because it's great that, first of all, it was found, although it did die, but that it was found, that the guys did their best to help the bird, but how they were going to get it back, I don't know. But anyway, they helped it, and now in time you'll be able to see it at the Natural History Museum. I mentioned the Arctic tern there. Plenty of them out in Dunleary on the piers. I've been walking along the west and the east pier, and the other evening I got the most amazing shot, and it's on our website, rte.ie/mini, of a grey heron, and it's scratching itself. But before it was scratching itself, it was resting on one leg. I know birds do this for heat conservation, and I will explain in a little bit more detail. But scratching itself and resting on one leg at the same time, I thought, for my next trick.
Well, herons are remarkable birds because they have a special thing on the bottom of a claw on each foot called pectinations. It's like a comb, little ridges in the bottom of their foot. They're the only birds that have that. And they use that to comb their plumage. So I think that's what this bird was doing. It was scratching, but in a very deliberate way. This little comb they have on their third toe, as it is, they do that to keep their breeding plumage in tip-top condition, because this is the breeding season. So I think that's what this heron was doing. It's quite a remarkable feat, really. Very good balance, unlike myself.
So it's standing on one leg, and it's not the old joke, boom, boom, why does it stand on one leg? Because if it lifted it up, it would fall over and collapse on the ground. It was actually standing on one leg because it was combing its plumage with the other leg.
That's what it was doing.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
Absolutely.
Because in the wintertime, don't they do it to conserve heat, because they've no feathers on their legs. And if you hold up one close to your body, you know, you won't be losing heat from one leg.
That's right,
but
exactly.
You wouldn't expect that in the summertime, would you?
No. That's right. Although it does show that the birds have a very good sense of balance. But a lot of long-legged birds, particularly in cold weather, what they do is they stand on one leg to reduce the heat loss. Exactly. Because their bodies are covered in feathers, which are remarkably good at insulating. It's like wearing a duvet with you all the time, wrapped up nice and warm. But then, of course, their legs have bare skin on them. Now, they have less blood flow in their legs than we mammals would. So they don't feel cold the same way that we would. But having said that, there would still be heat loss. They can minimise that by tucking one foot up underneath into the body feather, so it's wrapped up in the duvet, and then every so often they swap around. But that's in the winter.
Tell us about the comb. Is it only the heron? I mean, do egrets have it? Do purple herons, or is it just a grey heron?
No, it's all members of the heron family. So the little egret would have it, the bittern would have it. These marks on the third claw of each foot, and it really acts like a comb. And for those who've seen what a grey heron looks like, particularly this time of year in their breeding finery, they have these lovely plumes on their chest, on their head.
Well, you can see them really clearly in those pictures.
You get the fantastic, really atmospheric shots too, because you can see Dublin Bay behind.
Hazy.
You can see that,
and you can see the twin chimneys.
That's right.
It couldn't get to the hairdresser on account of COVID, so it was combing its long locks. We'd all have to get combs on our toes.
But it really is a terrific shot. This is a very friendly bird, you told me afterwards. Haven't you been down there with Sir Ryan Tuberty?
I went down there with Ryan Tuberty. He asked if I'd go bird watching with him, and he'd seen that heron there walking. He lives quite close by, and quite a lot of people have seen it down there. It's always at the end of the pier and standing there. I think some of the fishermen might feed it, so it's become accustomed to people, but it's remarkably tamed. Stands there on that wall sort of surveying everything like the Lord of the Manor. Lovely looking bird.
Well, it's a terrific shot, and you can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Moody. Towards the end of the programme today, John, our researcher will be in telling you how you can engage with us via social media, which has really taken off since we've moved to Sunday at 6 p.m. rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Tomorrow night, right here on RTE Radio 1 at 10 p.m, we'll give you a second chance to hear a documentary from the Mooney Goes Wild archive. 25 years of magnificence. Tomorrow's offering is about sparrows, and in it, you'll hear the tale of the domino sparrow. This is a fantastic story. Well, it's a bit sad as well for the sparrow, that is, of a sparrow which flew into a convention centre and knocked down some 23,000 odd dominoes during the setup for a world record breaking attempt. Anyway, here's Richard Collins talking to Kees Molliker. Kees Molliker is the director of the Natural History Museum in Rotterdam, where the sparrow was stuffed and mounted after it had caused such havoc.
It's a game they play here in the Netherlands. Every year there's a big show on TV and in elsewhere in Europe where they put up like millions of domino tiles. And then some famous artist or singer comes and pushes down one, and then everything is toppling.
The domino effect. First one knocks the second knocks the third knocks the fourth.
And it's
and so on and on and on and on and on. And the record for this was what, how many million?
Like 4 million, and every year they add another 100,000 to it.
So, and in a town called, you must pronounce it for me,
Leeuwarden,
they set up dominoes for an attempt on the world record.
That's right. Then a poor little sparrow flew into this exhibition hall and knocked down 23,000 tiles before the event really started. So that they weren't really happy with that, and they tried to chase off the sparrow, but it didn't move. It kept flying around, and then they decided to hire a pest controller, and he shot the sparrow.
And you can hear that documentary about sparrows right here on RTE Radio 1, Mooney Goes Wild, Second Chance, from 10 p.m. tomorrow evening. But right now, as you can hear, it's time to get physical. Sure, you're wondering what Olivia Neutron Bomb, as we used to call her when we were kids, Olivia Newton-John, and her song Physical, Let's Get Physical, has got to do with a nature program. And you're right for wondering, Terry Flanagan, what has it got to do with nature?
Well, Derek, during the week I met an old friend of the program, physiotherapist Jenny Branigan.
Oh, how is she?
She's great.
Good.
She's actually great, yeah. Wasn't she the official physio on the Mooney show at one stage?
She was in the afternoon, and then, sadly, the show finished. And here we are now, and Jenny moved on to bigger and better things. I know her business is thriving. She's up in Sandyford Industrial Estate, and I've heard her on with Sean O'Rourke before he retired, and I heard her on with Brendan O'Connor. In fact, there's nobody she won't go on air with. She has no shame.
Anyway, back to the story. I met with Jenny in Sandyford Industrial Estate. That's where she has her business now. And she told me that one of her clients noticed some activity of the feathered kind right above her door, and she invited me over to have a look.
So Terry, it was one of my patients that actually brought this to our attention. With the current COVID restrictions, everybody's having to sit outside the clinic until such time as we're ready to bring them in. And actually, he showed me an area where he spotted a sparrow had been bringing something up sort of into one of the eaves of the building. And then we kind of had a little further look and we spotted a couple of feathers around it. And then we saw that there was actually a nest up in the eaves. So I had noticed feathers around the area before, but I'd never really paid that much attention to it until this patient showed it to me. So I was kind of interested. Like, can you tell me more about that?
Well, yeah, we're just looking up at the nest now. It's just here in a small, tiny little opening there, just in the roof, just as you go into the door.
Yeah,
to
that's
your
it.
Building.
It's nearly behind the shutters.
Yes, yes. You can barely see it. So obviously, you have someone sitting there in the car watching things. Then they spot it.
Yeah.
I watched the birds going in and out of it, and they're house sparrows.
The house sparrows.
There are a number
okay.
of different species of sparrows, but this is the house sparrow. And the house sparrow is very, very common. Or should I say, the house sparrow was very, very common in Ireland. Not so much anymore. Their numbers have decreased considerably due to various things like lack of food, lack of nesting places, lack of insects in particular, because they feed the young on insects. So their numbers have dropped considerably. So it's lovely to see them, that they're nesting here.
And is it normal for them to nest? Like, they're right up in a building there. Like, why are they not nesting in a tree?
Because they've been associated with humans for about 10,000 years. So wherever humans go, the sparrows go. So if we build a house, they build a house beside us here, or build their house in our house. Why? Because we're providing them with what they need. We're providing them with a home, we're providing them with food. So they just want to be with us. Whereas there are tree sparrows, and tree sparrows will nest in trees. And hedge sparrows then are another species, which we now refer to as the dunnock, which are not actually related to this species at all. So this one here is the house sparrow, and if you look at the two of them, they're actually different. They show what's referred to as sexual dimorphism. Now, what that means is that he's different to her. Think of a peacock.
Okay.
Or think of a pheasant. He's the nice, big, bright, showy guy.
Yeah.
And she's the little dull one. Well, if you look at our ones here, you can see that he has that kind of lovely grey head and a black bib. And the bigger that black bib is, the stronger or the more dominant the male he is.
Okay, well, actually, I see one just flying in there now, actually, as we're standing here. That's amazing. And they don't seem fearful of us at all.
No, they live alongside us. They're cheeky little birds, if anything. You'll often see them come into, if you're eating out on the balcony or that, and, you know, drop a crumb or something, they come right up beside you and they'll feed off it.
Yeah, well, certainly even beside the clinic here, there's lots of cars and people moving in and out, and you can see them even moving up and down now that I'm paying attention to them. So, yeah, it's amazing they're not scared by us at all.
So it's definitely sparrows, Terry.
Definitely sparrows.
Now, is it not a bit late in the year for sparrows to be building nests and wooing partners and laying eggs and all the rest of it?
Not really. It's still midsummer, and they would have maybe three or four families during the year, three or four young in each. So, no, it's not too late at all.
So you're saying they're fairly prolific?
They certainly are.
Then why are the numbers dwindling? I mean, every time I hear somebody talking about sparrows, they say, oh, the sparrows, the decline of the sparrow numbers. In fact, we've made a documentary. I mentioned it. It's going out tomorrow night. You'll hear that being discussed. And some years ago, there was an offer from the London Independent, I think, of around £10,000 at the time for anybody who could give a reasonable explanation as to why the sparrow numbers were declining. So you're saying these birds breed several times in the one season, and yet their numbers are low.
Yes, their numbers are low. Certainly they're low in urban areas. And if you think of places like London, I think their numbers are down about 90% in London in the last 30 or 40 years or so. In Dublin, their numbers are down as well. But there are certainly pockets or areas. I know my own garden, there's quite a lot of them there. So they're doing well in small areas, but their numbers have definitely dropped.
Why? Could you win that 10 grand?
No, I couldn't win it. And nobody has won it as far as I know yet. There have been a number of reasons put forward as to why their numbers are dropping. Lack of food would be one, because they are seed eaters or grain eaters, and there's not as much food around now.
As many horses and carts
exactly, on the road. Exactly, exactly. In places like London, that was a classic one.
And here?
Yeah, two Guinnesses and places like that. Mm-hmm. I would also say too that they feed their young on insects. The young need the insects for protein, so at this time of the summer. So if we're using a lot of insecticides, there's not as many insects. Also, the habitat, they like to nest in houses. And nowadays, builders are actually better at building houses. So they're not leaving those little nooks and crannies and crevices. So there's not as many spaces for them to build nests within. All I can say is their numbers have definitely decreased. I would say it's probably a combination of everything.
A myriad of reasons. OK, shall we go back to Jenny?
Let's do.
So So what I really want to know then, Terry, is what is happening with these feathers? I mean, the bird is brown in colour. We see a couple of speckles of white on them. Are these white feathers that we're seeing floating around outside the clinic, are they actually sparrow feathers, or where are they coming from?
No, they're not necessarily sparrow feathers. I mean, what you have is you have a nest. Now, the nest tends to be very, very untidy, and it tends quite often to be made of man-made materials, bits of string and bits of plastic and everything, but they tend to line it with feathers. Now, the reason why they line it with feathers is because feathers are a great insulating material.
Okay.
So what they do is they put all these feathers on the inside. They don't have to be feathers from a sparrow. They can be any other feathers. And just as I pulled up and I met you, you saw me, I was taking photographs of the feathers.
That's right. There's lots of them around.
There is lots of them around here at the moment. And they are not sparrow feathers. But what the sparrows are doing is they're making use of them to line the nest. Now, a survey was done a number of years ago in the University of Cape Town and the University of Granada. It was a joint survey. And what they discovered was that the female hedge sparrow, she invests more energy into laying more eggs when the male brings more feathers to the nest. So more feathers, more eggs laid. So it's a bit like humans, I suppose. If he brings home lots more money, you might have more kids.
Absolutely, that's very interesting.
It was a really interesting study. What they did was they studied 50 nests and they started taking some feathers from some of the nests and adding feathers to the other nests. And they watched the reactions of the females. And in the case of where the feathers were being removed, the female realised this and she became really agitated and called himself in. Come in here. And there was a big row.
Yeah.
And he was sent out. Go out and get more feathers. So off he goes out and gets more feathers. So what you're probably seeing here is you're probably seeing him going out getting more feathers to line the nest to make sure that those eggs are kept really nice and warm in the nest.
Okay, and is it a bit late to be still feathering the nest at this stage in the year? Like, we've passed the longest day already.
Yes, we have indeed, just gone by. But they will have two or three or four broods in the year.
Okay.
So they may be on a second brood. Or because they're colonial, they nest very, very close together. It wouldn't be unknown for one female to start picking or stealing some feathers from another female's nest when she has eggs or young in it.
Mm-hmm.
So then she might say, hey, these feathers are gone. I need more feathers.
Okay. And are they picky about the types of feathers? I mean, where we are here, we're not too far from the sea. There are tons of seagulls around.
Yes, yeah.
Do they specifically look for larger feathers are there more downy feathers
More downy feathers, because feathers have a number of functions, and their primary function, in fact, is to keep the bird warm, not for flight. So what you're seeing here are these small feathers. They're the downy feathers, and they are, as you saw, lots of gulls here, little white feathers. They're either from pigeons or from gulls. Birds have thousands of feathers. For instance, a swan has 25,000 feathers.
25,000, wow. No wonder Stephen's Green is covered.
So what you have here is you have a lovely little family.
Okay.
And you hear them chirping away all the time.
Yeah, you can
certainly
hear them. And tell me, so when we are trying to clean up outside the clinic and sweep away feathers, should we be leaving them there?
I'd leave them. Leave
we
the feathers. You might clean up
there.
The poo, but leave the feathers.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. Thanks, Terry.
The sparrow poo, Terry. I hasten to add, probably should have added in. Thank you very much indeed, Terence and Jenny. Any, were you going to say something about sparrows there?
Yes, I was going to say, people always know about China and Mao Zedong and famines. Do you know Zola? Zola is a famous...
Emile Zola?
In France, time of the Impressionists. He was a writer. But he was so poor, that he lived in a garret.
I accuse, wasn't that the letter he wrote or something?
And he wrote, yeah, he did. But anyway, he had
written
a bit about
starting. I won't even attempt to say
garret. He lived in a garret. He had only bread and olive oil. And he used to catch sparrows and eat them.
Did he?
He did indeed. It wouldn't be an awful lot of sparrows. There wouldn't be much eating on a sparrow.
But don't the French eat the ortolan
and bunting? Illegally, I have to say. Yeah, that's
I know,
very
but he was eating the sparrows out of starvation. But it must be hard to catch a sparrow and put a cup over it and nab it and then pluck it and eat it. I mean, the poor man must have been starving. Anyway, he was good at the writing. He was pally with the impressionists. And he was a gourmand all his life afterwards. He used to eat enormous quantities of food when he could afford them. But he started out eating
sparrows.
He was
good at the writing. You should be a critic. the sparrows.
Yes.
Actually, we should mention the ortolan, first of all. I mean, I threw it away there, but you might explain
I will.
The tradition of biting the poor bird's head off and dousing it in...
It's
very unpleasant, whatever they do.
Yeah, so there's a bird, yeah, a bird called Ortolan bunting, and it's about the size of a sparrow, lovely little colourful bird, related to our yellowhammer, if anyone knows that bird here in Ireland. Anyway, about the size of a sparrow, and traditionally in France what would happen is they would catch these birds, they would lure them in by having a captive male Ortolan bunting singing in a cage, and they have this sort of net trap beside that would fall over and catch the bird when they were drawn in. And then they would take them and unfortunately they would blind them with a needle or with a wire so they couldn't see. And this apparently has the response of making them want to gorge themselves on food. So they keep them in a place to stuff themselves full of grain. And then when they're nice and fat, what they would do is then they would drown them in Armagnac.
Armagnac.
And then they would eat them whole, cook them and eat them whole, feathers, head, bones and everything, and swallow them right down. And
as their flesh was impregnated and their lungs with the brandy in which they drowned. Horrible.
And apparently, you know, it was considered a real delicacy. People used to eat them with a blindfold over their eyes so that hiding their whole head so that God could see their sin.
From that documentary series about Charlie Hoy.
Charlie Hoy. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't a drama series about Charlie Hoy, where it was a Meteoron or something like that.
It was Meteoron's favourite food.
It was his last meal, Meteoron.
Whether Charles Hoy ever did actually have ortolans below in his Ishvickalon is maybe poetic license, but certainly it was Meteoron's favourite and his last meal.
What I would say is I do know that Charlie Hoy himself was a keen birdwatcher, so to be fair, I would be very surprised if he would have done that. It wouldn't be something that a birdwatcher would want to do. It is totally illegal nowadays, but unfortunately it still does happen in France, and our colleagues there, the LPO, the Bird Life Partner in France, had a campaign to try and stop this.
Well, mentioning Inishvickalon, and you didn't mention the white-tailed sea eagles, but they spring to mind straight away, because that's where Charlie Hoy wanted to introduce, if I'm not mistaken, white-tailed sea eagles.
That was one of the proposals, yes.
One of the proposals.
Right. Maeve and Aliel, he brought them there. Mm-hmm. Maeve and Aliel, two of them. And one of them actually died, and the other flew away and was never seen again, because when he brought them in way back in the 70s, there was nothing for them to feed on. Mm. They just died. They died of starvation.
Well, they were subsequently reintroduced, and they're doing okay. Yeah. And this week, another 10 birds were brought from Norway.
That's right.
To Ireland. Now, we were there at the very beginning of this entire project. Terry went, I think it was 2007.
Yeah, that's right.
And he went out to Norway and he came back on the plane with the first chicks that were brought in. But we have a link on the website to the live camera feed on the nest of a pair of these white-tailed sea eagles, and it really is terrific if you want to have a look at that. But now 10 were brought in this week.
Yeah, to try and bolster the population, because as you said, the white-tailed eagles, they've been doing okay in Ireland, but the breeding has been slow. A few were lost, unfortunately, to poisoning, a few illegal poisoning, a few were lost to accidents and so on. Some were shot, sadly. So this is an attempt to bolster the population. It's a real cooperation between Ireland and Norway. These are gifts from the nation of Norway. And we should bear in mind that when birds of prey are persecuted, it does make headlines in Norway. So they are watching what we're doing here in Ireland. Let's hope it'll be a success. They're having these magnificent birds. These eagles look like barn doors when they're flying through the sky. They're enormous. So
have a look at the live feed, because it is terrific. rte.ie/Mooney, and Jarlath will put the link, and you can see the actual goings on of the nest as you watch it. Just very quickly about the sparrows, why are the numbers declining?
Well, a big part of it is that lack of nesting sites. So modern buildings,
as Kerry was saying.
Yeah, fewer nooks and crannies. So nesting sites. Also, overuse of pesticides sometimes changes in the environment. Fewer insects around to feed the chicks.
Yeah. Okay, there's an email there. Well, several emails. Do you want to read out one just before we go to the break?
Well, the one there, it says, there was a bee cocoon under a bush in Tralee General Hospital. A few baby wasps fell out of it and landed on the ground. They rolled around and flew away. The babies were so tiny. Well, now, you couldn't have a bee cocoon.
That's from Siobhan Daly.
In Siobhan Daly. It couldn't be a bee cocoon in which there were wasps. I mean, it's either bees or they're wasps. So, in fact, the bee cocoon is probably a wasp's nest. It's probably because they're made of paper and they're little roundy things, and they do look like a cocoon. And, of course, once they fly away, they're not baby wasps anymore. They're actual full adults, because baby wasps are actually grubs. They're actually smaller things in the nest. So that's interesting that they have wasps breeding down there. But if it fell on the ground and the little babies, would be 8 of them in it to begin with. Well, there you go. Good to observe it. And I'm glad she didn't attack them or kill them or do anything nasty like that. Because wasps are good. They're carnivores and they eat all the green flies and black flies and white flies in your garden all summer.
Take pictures, send them to mooney@rte.ie.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Email mooney@rte.ie.
Niall, you've got some emails.
I do. I have a message here in no name, unfortunately, but it says, "Hi guys, I'm driving my truck in the Midlands in Westmeath. In the same area for the last couple of days, a very large wingspan bird of prey has flown across in front of me. Can you tell me what it would be? It was very big and really dark brown in colour." So that sounds to me like it was a buzzard. I'd be almost certain that's what it was. These are big birds of prey, and sometimes people mistake them for eagles. They're not quite as big as an eagle, but they're still large birds. They hunt rats and rabbits and crows and things like that. They were extinct in Ireland for a long time, but over the last couple of decades they've made a big resurgence. Naturally, they've come back in from Northern Ireland, heading down through East Leinster and then headed west.
Yeah, they're farmland birds.
Farmland
you would
birds.
Get them in flat areas.
That's
not
right.
Like eagles on cliffs and things like that.
Yeah, so here on the East Coast in Dublin and in Wicklow where I live, we see them quite commonly, but they're becoming more common in other counties now. So it was a few years ago they started breeding in Westmeath. They're now breeding in all 32 counties of Ireland again, which is great. So I think people will see them more and more. And they're often flying over motorways. They're very large wingspan. They often circle high in the sky. Beautiful bird.
All right, so most likely a buzzard. Now, new research by NUI Galway has found that wet wipes and sanitary towels are an underestimated source of white microplastic pollution in the marine environment. The article, which has been published in the international journal Water Research, also revealed that 50% of the wet wipe brands tested, which were labelled flushable, were not actually biodegradable. The study, which was carried out across three locations in Galway, Clare and Mayo, examined sediment at Grattan Beach, close to the wastewater treatment plant at Mutton Island in Galway City. They found it riddled with white microplastic fibres. The lead researcher of the study is marine scientist Dr. Liam Morrison from the Earth and Ocean Sciences and the Ryan Institute at NUI Galway. And Richard spoke with him during the week.
Liam, wipes and sanitary towels are being flushed down toilets. Are they harmless?
No, they are not harmless. Our study in Galway showed that 50% of the flushable wipes that we studied were shown to be manufactured from plastic and contained plastics. And ultimately, these wipes, if they end up in the marine environment as a result of combined sewage overflows and getting out into the ocean, they will fragment or they'll break down into small white microplastic fibres. It's well known that microplastics have harmful effects in the oceans. One of the things to date is that the vast majority of microplastic fibres in the oceans have been considered to be derived from grey water. In other words, from the washing of clothing in your washing machines. And these are described as, you know, synthetic fibres from clothing and very much fibres associated with sanitary waste, including wipes, have been very much underestimated in our marine system and in our environment to date.
Let's go with a wipe down the toilet, in along the pipes, onto the sewage system. Now, are we talking only about situations where the sewage system is overloaded and the effluent ends up in the sea? If it passes through the sewage system in the ordinary way, is there still a problem?
No. Most wastewater treatment facilities are very effective at removing microplastics, or certainly effective at removing a large proportion of them. And in normal circumstances, there is screening and filtering of some process that remove these products from the sewer systems. However, what the study in Galway showed was that when we get periods of heavy rainfall, we get combined sewage overflows, so where stormwater combines with the sewers. And basically, there's so much water in the system that it reaches a capacity that the facility can't deal with it, and we get these combined sewage overflows. And that's when this sanitary waste leaves the system and ends up washed up on our beaches, as we've seen in Galway. And this contains a whole range of products. Our study mainly focused on wet wipes and on sanitary towels, because they were quite common, particularly wipes, among the material that was washed up. And just going back to talking about it in the sewage system, wipes also cause technical difficulties, and these materials cause technical difficulties in the sewage system, because it has been shown globally that they can cause blockages. They can combine with other organic waste, things like oils, and they cause these fatbergs, which cause blockages. And these are, you know, great cost to local authorities to actually clear the sewers of these.
Let's look at this from the perspective of a creature living in the mud in Galway Bay. Suppose I'm a freshwater mussel or something like that. Will I encounter these little fibres and will I filter them in? And will they build up in my body? And will the things that eat me change as a result? Is this going to affect the food chain?
Okay, well, so we can look at this from the point of view that we have seen that, you know, microplastics can definitely have an adverse effect. And you talked about a mussel. So studies have shown that they can actually, in fact, disrupt the filtering mechanism in mussels. And even at the plankton level, we have seen that they can disrupt algal feeding. You know, you talk about it moving through the food chain. Yes, studies have shown that they can biomagnify. So if the microplastics accumulate in organisms and then they can move through the food chain up to top predators at the top of the food chain like ourselves. And we also have to be careful in terms of contaminants. We know that they can accumulate things like pharmaceuticals and metals. And if they accumulate or take up a significant quantity of them, this can in turn give rise to increased levels of these contaminants in the tissues of the organisms.
So is there actual evidence that microplastics in our bodies are harmful? We take in all kinds of substances, petrochemical deposits and all kinds of things, and most of them don't seem to have any effect or any discernible effect. Is there evidence that microplastics are different in this regard?
Well, that's an area of ongoing research, and to date, most of the research has been conducted in the marine environment and on marine organisms. I think a study from China last year showed the presence of microplastics in humans, in stool samples, and that's an area of research that's actually growing, where people are looking at microplastics in the lungs from breathing in, and also in things like the lining of gut tissue. But we certainly aren't as advanced yet in terms of human of studies on microplastic interactions and effects with humans.
Well, would you like to prescribe or proscribe a course of action for the future? What should we do and what should we not do about this?
If you look at over the last 50, 60 years, global production of plastics has increased significantly. And look around you in the room you're in, certainly in the room I'm in. Most things are made of plastic. And the study in Galway, while, you know, the point I've made is that we all welcome improvements in our sewer infrastructure and network. But at the same time, sewers can only cope with what people are putting down there. And if material like flushable and non-flushable, or specifically non-flushable wipes and sanitary towels, are being put down toilets, the thing is for humans to actually change that. People can make a decision and decide, we're not going to do that anymore, and then we won't have as much of them in the sewer system. And, you know, one of the important issues, I think, coming from this study is that identifying sources of microplastics is very important in terms of strategies for, I suppose, management of reductions of the quantities of microplastics, and also around policy. And one of the things about wet wipes in particular is that there is a lack of regulation in the industry. Most of the wipes, if not all of the wipes that we looked at, none of them identified the composition, we'll say, of the base material as containing microplastics. There's no regulation around that. Also, even the positioning of the logo to do not flush does not often adhere to industry guidelines on the packaging. And there are industry guidelines. Now, I know there's a directive coming in next year and there will probably be regulation from that. But definitely identifying sources is important. Increasing public awareness of the potential hazardous effects of these products, and then convincing people not to actually flush them down their toilets, and clear labelling, that it's clear to people how to actually use and dispose of them correctly, and move them to alternative land-based waste management.
Liam, thank you very much. Changing the nappies of my grandchildren, there's one or two still young enough to have their nappy changed, will never be the same after this.
Thank you, Richard. No problem. My pleasure.
Mooney Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Now, you know, we like to showcase some of the photographs and videos sent in to Mooney at rte.ie, be it a photograph of an iridescent butterfly captured on an evening stroll, a video of otters at play in a river in your area, or an audio recording like this one, sent to us by Pam McHugh in Dublin. Do you know what it is? Have a listen. That goo-goo sound. And Niall Hatch tells us that that very curious sound is in fact a crow. Crows, it seems, are capable of making all sorts of weird noises. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and you can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. To tell us more, we have our own researcher, John Bella Riley. John.
Yes, Derek, and our email and social media never sleep. You can send us a message or check out and contribute to and comment on our social media anytime. As you say, we get audio recordings, videos, and of course, we get lots of beautifully captured photographs sent in every day. Much of it comes with a question attached, and our experts will endeavour to answer that question. Many of the videos and photos that are sent in are people sharing shots that they've taken of their own local wildlife. Where suitable, we ask them if we can share these on our Facebook and Twitter feeds. We don't share everything, Derek. For example, we wouldn't share 20 photos of foxes in back gardens sent in the same week. But what we try to do instead is we try to keep our social media feeds as much a celebration of Ireland's biodiversity as we can. We get some really well-studied shots of birds with kingfishers, grey heron and little egrets among the most popular subjects these weeks.
But not the most numerous, I wouldn't have thought. I mean, I send a lot of pictures of grey herons because I see a lot of them around when I'm out walking, but kingfisher is a hard one to spot.
Yes, it is. And we've got a really nice clip with Taryn Barling, where she talks about how people along the Dodder, how you see them clustering together with very long telephoto lenses studying the kingfishers on the Dodder there. We get some really dramatic and close-up shots of insects, damselflies, hummingbird hawk moths and bumblebees are among our favourites. And I think it's well worth going to our Facebook and Twitter to check out some of the hummingbird hawk moth videos that have been sent in. And of course, we get mammals with foxes, pine martens and squirrels all represented. Maureen Kelleher sent in a photo of a deer taken at Killarney National Park, County Kerry. Here she describes the morning she happened upon that close encounter with the red stag.
Well, I usually do walks around the national park since we live outside Killarney, and the stags usually congregate around Knocker House. So one morning I was waiting on the footpath because I saw them all, and they started to walk into across the path to the other field. And I was very lucky to capture him. I waited there with my camera for about 10 minutes and I just took a picture of this majestic stag staring back at me.
Can you tell us, where did this interest in wildlife, where do you think it comes from?
I think it stemmed from my dad's interest in nature. Like as a kid, my dad would take us fishing, and because we live so close to National Park, we would go for walks all the time. And my dad was like the local David Attenborough, who would tell us all the facts about the trees and the wildlife in the area.
Maureen Kelleher telling us there how she was bitten by the nature bug early in life. And John, we also get some fantastic video.
We get a lot of video sent in, and video tends to get a particularly big reaction, and some of it wouldn't look out of place in some of the better wildlife series seen on TV. And when we share these videos, they get great engagement, are widely shared, and I think reflect the huge appetite for good local wildlife footage. Fionn O'Donoghue sent us in a short film which he shot close to his home in Cavan Town and also along the River Dodder in Dublin. As with a lot of other footage sent in, Fionn recorded much of the video during lockdown. The film features fallow deer, foxes and a kingfisher. And here, Fionn explains that some of his subject matter was a little camera shy.
I tried to get a whole array of species. So the likes of the pine marten, which actually took months to actually get a film off because they're quite elusive. As you probably know, they're generally nocturnal animals, but during the summer months, they can be found knocking about in the forest, and many hours were spent in the hide without getting anything. But eventually I got that one bit of footage. I do plan on getting more, but that's all I've got for now.
You built a hide?
Well, I have a little portable hide.
How much time did you spend in the hide?
The most to date, actually on my YouTube channel, I've recently made a video where I've spent 11 hours in the hide. I got some wonderful shots off some jay, and some of the fallow deer came through. A female with two roe, and they have to be one of the most personal shots that I've got to date. And it really is the hide, but there's a lot of weight and a lot of patience, but it's never a dull day, really.
Never a dull day in the hide, Derek. And that was Fionn O'Donoghue from Cavan, who sent us in his wildlife film to mooney@rte.ie, and which now can be seen on our Facebook and Twitter feeds. You can see Fionn's work there and also on his YouTube channel and his Facebook page. Simply search those sites for Fionn O'Donoghue.
What about birds, Sean? As mentioned, we get in audio recordings and, of course, we get photos.
Yes, Derek, we get a lot of photos of birds. Taryn Barling sent in some beautifully captured images, which can be seen in her Facebook and Twitter feeds. I asked Taryn, where did she take these great wildlife shots?
Okay, well, it was along the Lower Dodder Road, and you can walk along the top of the bank, and you can also walk down the lower part of the bank. So you get a great view on either side. And normally I wouldn't have the time to dedicate to my photography, but I've had a bit more time through lockdown and appreciate what's on my doorstep. And even today we managed to see a little egret, a juvenile goldfinch, some ducklings, a grey heron, and that was in the space of half an hour. So,
Taryn, you sent us in some really stunning photographs of a grey heron, a kingfisher and a mandarin duck. Which of those was the most memorable?
Definitely capturing the kingfisher, because they're such a fast bird, and I love the colours, and yeah, that would definitely be a highlight. But the easiest way to spot the kingfisher is to walk along and see a number of other photographers with long lenses, and then you know you're onto something good. You know you're going to get a winner shot then.
That was Taryn Barling reporting on the wildlife along the River Dodder. So, John, what do people need to bear in mind if sending in their audio recordings, videos and photographs?
There are a number of different things people should keep in mind, Derek. One, don't disturb the scene. Allow it to be natural. Don't bait animals to the spot by providing food. Two, we would ask that people, if they're sending in footage, that they don't get too close and that they don't chase the shot. This can be fatal, particularly near nests where new bird parents could abandon the nests. Three, to get familiar with the animal's behaviour and routines. Understanding when, for example, badgers or pine martens are at their most active will lead to better shots. Number four, patience is a virtue. Animals, like people, tend to become more relaxed when they get used to our presence in their environment and will exhibit more natural behaviour, again leading to better photography. Finally, send your stuff into mooney@rte.ie. We do try to acknowledge everything sent in, but again, try not to be too disappointed if we don't post everything you send, as there are editorial considerations around diversity, animal welfare, photograph clarity, etc. Also, it would be great if you could tell us when you're sending it in that you're okay with us sharing it.
John, thank you very much indeed. You can text us now about anything at all to 51551.
Yes, I'm just thinking about the wet wipes. Mm-hmm. We'll have to go back to when my children were young. We had wet wipes of a different sort, Derek, and I'm sure your mother had them too when your face was covered in ice cream. You take out your hanky, you spit on it and you wipe the muck off your face. And the kids hated it. Did it happen to you?
It did, absolutely. Did bringing back some dark memories. I remember squirming away from it, yeah. Sorry, yes, Mum.
And there was no wet wipes thrown anymore. We were too miserable and mean to be spending money on things that are only used once. And I think you'll have to go back to this.
June in Kildare says, I live in North Kildare and am alarmed at the absence of our once plentiful buzzards. What's happening? Thank you very much, says June in Kildare.
Well, I hope nothing is amiss. Certainly if it's just a very recent thing, hopefully they're breeding at the moment. They do keep a low profile sort of in May, June, July when they're on the nest with their young. And then hopefully then in the next few weeks, you might see them coming out with the young. Everything will be okay. So I hope nothing untoward has happened, but it's normal enough this time of year.
I love feeding the birds in my back garden. We have lots of different species, but unfortunately, a hawk has been around for the last few days, says Texter. Anyway, I can get rid of him, please. I love the show. Well, of course, we're not going to tell you because this is the wildlife show. And a hawk is great. I mean, what do you want to be getting rid of it for? What do hawks eat? Only sparrowhawks are going to eat small baby birds because they can't all survive anyway. And if they all survive and the hawk doesn't get them, they'll die of hunger in the wintertime. It's part of the food chain. And anyway, a hawk is worth 20 little baby birds, I think. Hawks are great. That would be a sparrowhawk, wouldn't it?
Almost certainly a sparrowhawk in a garden, yes.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much indeed to Niall Hatch, to Aineen Lana. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. On sound, we had Sheila Nivuil. And our researcher, as you heard earlier, is John Bella Riley. We'll do it all again next week. Until then, bye!
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.